You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, listen up, you beautiful people. I know you don't want to. Heaven knows I don't even want to. But sometimes you just have to. It's time to talk about inflation, because it's coming our way, and you need to know what effects it's going to have and how to prepare yourself for it. So why don't you pause this podcast, get yourself a nice coffee, because we're going to discuss it so you don't have to. Whether it's the consumer in the shop, the commodity buyer, the factory owner, or the supermarket that has to pay the heating bill amongst everything else, all links in the food chain will be affected by rising prices. It raises all sorts of questions about the functioning of our food system, but also about the long-term effect of food price rises on public health. Well, I'm joined by two fantastic experts to look at the causes and ask, where's it all heading and what can we do to prepare ourselves? Because after all, forewarned is forearmed. With me are Professor Tim Lloyd, Professor of Economics at Bournemouth University. Hello there, Tim.
Hi there, Stefan.
Thanks for joining us. And we've got Fraser McKevitt, Head of Retail and Consumer Insight at data insights and consulting company Kantar. Hello there, Fraser.
Well, absolute pleasure.
Well, great to have you both. Now, I hope you've got some great jokes to lift this episode a bit. Tim, I'm hoping that you've got a tight five on mother-in-laws and inflation to whip this baby into gear, right?
I've got one or two on economists, but I'll save those till the finale.
Till we really need it, yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let me start off by asking this to you, Tim. Is everything going to be terrible, but we're recording this in the middle of February 2022. What is the general picture with inflation as we speak, and how important a role are food prices playing in that?
Well, Stefan, we're living in dynamic times. Prices in general, like, were rising at about 5.5% in January. Just to give you some idea, a year ago, they were less than 1%.
Yeah.
And so things are changing rapidly, and food inflation is a sort of a key part of the overall story. But if I can just say something about general inflation itself, you know, it's a dynamic picture at the moment. Things are changing rapidly. Although general inflation is sort of reasonably high in sort of recent terms, 5.5%, you know, I'm old enough to remember the 1970s when inflation was 20-25%.
Yeah.
So if you look back over a much longer timescale, what we're going through now is relatively modest. But it's the fact that things are changing is the key issue. And also, whenever we're talking about inflation, and also sort of food inflation in particular, we've got to be aware of what's been referred to as the white rainbow problem. You know, we're dealing with averages, and, you know, the average colour of a rainbow, you know, is white, but that hides the huge diversity of experience that people are going to face, because we can think of rates of inflation as being very personal things.
That's very beautifully put, Tim. I think that's really interesting to put it that way.
And that really leads us to the sort of the key societal issue, is that it is going to be the poorest members of society that are actually affected the most from food inflation.
And that's what we're really worried about. But can you explain to me why that is? Why is it the poorest that get the real hit from this?
It's simply because they spend a higher proportion of their budget on food, and the households in the poorest 10% of the population will spend, you know, upwards of about 30% on food, whereas households in the highest 10% of the population will spend anywhere around sort of 5% on food, despite spending a great deal more on food itself. It's just that their incomes are much higher than their spending on food.
Yeah. And before we get into the detail, what's the prognosis? Any expectations looking ahead? I mean, I know that the world's relatively volatile at the moment, but do we have any expectations about what's going to happen over the next year?
Yeah, it's not looking good, I'm afraid. There are pressures almost everywhere that we can see. Energy is driving everything. You know, the price of oil is reaching nearly $100 a barrel as we speak. And Forecasts say that April's going to be the sort of the peak, and we're going to look at sort of inflation of about 7.5%. Lots of things are happening in April. National insurance is changing as well, so there's going to be a real squeeze on sort of family budgets in April. And I think just going on through, because the thing that keeps economists awake at night is not inflation itself, but what it does to perceptions about wage claims. And it's the wage price spiral that is really damaging to the economy. And in a way, that's as much a psychological issue as it is an economic one. You know, if people feel that they're in a strong position in the employment market, they're going to be appealing for higher wages. And the sort of the wage price spiral can lead to all sorts of problems, as we saw in the 1970s.
Oh, I could only dream of a wage price spiral myself, but there you go. Okay, so now I think, Fraser, we need to pull it apart a little bit for the food industry itself. What is causing the food prices to rise? Tim's mentioned a couple of things, but it is a sort of perfect storm, isn't it? Can you fill in the gaps for me?
There is a little bit of a perfect storm. And I think, first of all, Tim was quite right to sort of look back historically. But people got very short-term memories. So even within much, much more recent times, we have been where food price inflation, which is currently on food, is running at about 4%. So slightly behind the overall level of inflation. You know, back in the early days of the pandemic, it was running at that kind of level. We had it sort of 2011 through 2013. It was also running a similar kind of level. We'd forgotten about that. It was just normal then. But perhaps there weren't the other pressures, you know, there weren't the energy costs, etc., because that was made mostly brought about by exchange rate devaluation, making imports more expensive. And then finally, just back to 2008-2009, food price inflation was running at 10%. And the reason it's so important for the food industry, beyond, you know, there's not many jokes in this area, is there, Stefan? Because it's not funny, these prices going up. And it does hit poor people disproportionately hard. But why it's really important for the food industry is you try and look at how people's food purchasing and consumption changes against other major economic indicators. You start looking against GDP growth. You start looking against slightly softer measures like consumer confidence. It makes very little difference to what people spend on foods, particularly in the supermarkets, perhaps out and about in cafes and restaurants, a little bit different. But the economic marker that does make a change is rising prices. And in our data, we see that once inflation hits about 4%, perhaps maybe slightly less, 3.5%, people start mitigating their own cost rises, basically. And they do that by, you know, walking into a shop and they go, right, I don't want to pay 10% more for my pasta this week. But that's really not in my interest. What do I do? Do I buy less pasta? Do I buy a cheaper pasta? Do I only buy the pasta that's on promotion? Or do I walk out of that shop and go to a shop that I perceive to be a cheaper shop and buy my pasta there? So all these things kind of come together, which make it, you know, quite a volatile time for our, you know, major food retailers. And then, of course, then that flows back in the supply chain to all the people who are supplying them. And that pressure is getting passed down the line. Now, the fact that food inflation is currently running behind the general rate of inflation is a bit like a dam. You know, we might not feel like it. And if you're a food producer, you might think you're at the, you know, at the sharp end of this wedge. We do have a very competitive food sector in this country. And that's because it's very easy to choose where we shop. It's not like buying a car. You make a decision for 4 years and you're done. If you don't like what you see today, the next time you go shopping later this week, you shop somewhere else. So it's a very competitive industry. But at some point, if it costs more to drive the truck, it costs more in agriculture and fertilizer, which, of course, you know, both of those are based essentially on oil. Labor costs have gone up. Obviously, we've had a pandemic and slightly contentious territory. Has Brexit made an impact on labor costs or not? That's not one for me to answer, but I'll just throw it into the mix. And I have to say, it can't have made things any cheaper, the friction that we're seeing at the borders at the moment. Now, people will argue, is that material or is that not? But it's certainly not easier to get goods into the country than it was a couple of years ago. And all of those things add up to rising prices. And I think supermarkets have generally been keeping the price of food down over that critical Christmas period where it's all so competitive. And they don't want to move first, but that dam is now breaking. And we're starting to see food prices flowing through. And I do agree with Tim's analysis. I can't see any way out for the rest of this year, if food prices continue to go up, maybe actually up quite sharply, and they'll certainly remain at quite high levels for quite a time.
So you mentioned two things I'd like to pull apart a little bit. You're talking about absorbing price rises, which is a really interesting concept, but also you talked about the balance of consumer spend. And I wondered which sectors suffer most when the squeeze really hits. I mean, are we talking luxury goods and chocolates, or is it more about own brand to branded products? Who gets the worst of the hit?
Yeah, that's actually quite a complicated question, because you need to interlay. I suppose what economists would flag as rational decisions about what costs more, and I'll then buy something cheaper, or I won't buy that luxury sector. But that's overlaid with some quite strong consumer trends. So, for instance, let's just pick a trend of recent years. If I want to buy a non-dairy milk, an oat milk or a pea milk or whatever it might be, they're considerably more expensive than anything you get out of a cow.
Yep.
But there's been phenomenal growth in that area because people are willing to spend on it. So it's not as simple as saying, oh, the expensive things get bought less. The other thing is there's a sort of trickle down. The most expensive place we pay for our food and drink is, well, I don't know, the last time you bought a coffee in a Starbucks or a Costa or wherever, that's well over £2, could be over £3 a coffee. Compare that to the cost of making a coffee at home. It's a tenth of the price in that.
The margin's completely different, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, completely different, and different expectations and different experience, and we're willing to pay for it. So perhaps the best way to save money as a consumer is just to eat out of the house less. But that's then quite complicated to work out what's going on, because if I am stopping eating out and drinking out of the house quite as much, then when I come to the supermarket and my purchase in there, even if I buy the poshest thing on the shelf, it's actually considerably cheaper than what I've saved money on. So there's this strange dynamic. And so currently, and certainly over the last couple of years, the fastest growing tier of goods in supermarkets has actually been what we call in the industry premium own labels. So it's the likes of Tesco Finest, Sainsbury's Taste the Difference. All of those brands have been growing faster than anything else, which doesn't speak on the face of it to people wanting to save money. But if I'm doing that because I'm not eating and drinking elsewhere, then that could be an effect. The final thing to put into the mix, in previous periods of high inflation, we have seen this drift towards people buying cheaper products. There's no doubt about it. The data is all quite murky at the moment because we're all coming out of that C word, COVID. So the trends that you might expect to be really clear are actually quite murky, because volume that is being bought in supermarkets at the moment is going down year on year. It's still up about 8% on 2 years ago. We're still not going out and about and travelling and eating and drinking on high streets as much as we did. But that means that overall spending, your overall supermarket bill, is probably coming down at the moment. So it's quite hard to unpick, basically, all of those things together. But from previous periods of high inflation, I would expect we will start to see people buying cheaper products. That's not just about what people want, though, because quite a lot of that control is what retailers put on the shelf.
Yeah, what's available. Yeah.
And they have their own decisions to make. They want to be competitive against their rivals, but they also want to keep the mix of, have I got the right mix of some high margin products and some low margin products as well?
And it's complicated as well by delivery services, which over the last couple of years have just exploded. And so it's quite difficult to know how the change is going to unfold. But Tim, let's go back to the other thing that Fraser mentioned, which I'm fascinated by, which is the concept of absorbing price rises. Now, I've heard lots of the retailers say, we will absorb as much as we can. We will take the hit. We will try not to pass price rises on to consumers. Is this bullshit? I mean, do they really do that, or do they just push the squeeze further down the line and squeeze their suppliers? I mean, I'm slightly baffled. I kind of think supermarkets margin is relatively low anyway, isn't it?
It certainly is. It's a very, very competitive sector, and I guess that there's going to be a lot of everything going on. So the supermarkets will have learnt the hard way from the last time we had a sort of big bout of food inflation post 2008. The discounters came in and stole their market share, and they don't want that to happen again. So they're acutely aware of the impact of food inflation. So they will be wanting to cut costs at every possible turn. And so that's going to mean reducing their margins temporarily.
And do you think they genuinely do reduce their margins? I mean, they will take the hit themselves, or is it just a story that pleases the consumer?
Well, I don't have any data to show you that demonstrates that, but I would have thought that is a natural sort of part of the battery of responses that they can fight this war with, really. But clearly they do have a great deal of power to those further up the chain. You know, their suppliers are dependent upon the retailers, and there's very few of them in this country. And so retailers do command a great deal of power, and they are going to exercise that power as best they can further up the chain. And so I can imagine that suppliers will also be taking a real hit as retailers try and maintain their prices.
So I guess they're also trying to maintain market share, because when inflation changes the landscape of how the consumer spends, it's a land grab opportunity, isn't it? So for the discounters like Aldi and Lidl, this is a potential moment in time where they can grab land. So in a sense, it might make sense for the big retailers, the Sainsbury's and Tesco's, to spend just simply in order to weather this out. Is that likely? Is that a reality, do you think, Tim?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Sainsbury's and other supermarkets are price matching Lidl for this very reason. They're terrified of losing market share for them. You know, a promiscuous shopper is not good news if you're one of the mainstream retailers. You want a shopper to come to your store for all of their goods. As soon as they start to move away to one of the discounters, they'll realise, perhaps I'll try this group of products that I hadn't thought were on sale in the discounter. So it's a real threat to all mainstream retailers, actually.
Yeah.
To go back to Tim's point about sort of what happened post the financial crisis and the discounters, Aldi and Lidl, gaining a lot of market share, the one difference, I think, this time round, as we enter a period of high inflation, was there was a degree of complacency amongst some of our major food retailers during that 2010 decade. And I remember reading financial reports from some of our retailers, and they were boasting about maintaining margins and how they had worldwide leading margins at that time. And Aldi and Lidl, quite frankly, took advantage of that, and they made themselves a lot cheaper. We work with a lot of those major retailers, and I don't think there's any complacency now about Aldi and Lidl. The battle for, if you're one of those mainstream retailers, is how do you get someone to stay in your shop instead of going somewhere that is perceived to be cheaper? And Tim, addressed the price matching against Aldi, that Sainsbury's and Tesco also have a program on that. They're trying to reassure people there. It's a slightly strange marketing thing to talk about your rival in your advertising, but they've obviously, weighed up the odds there and decided that that's the right thing to do. And they're also offering value in some very different ways. It's not about promotions these days. Yeah. Promotion, we've tracked promotions on a similar basis for about 15 years. We're at the lowest level we've ever seen on that now, well under 30% of sales value going through promotions.
And any idea why?
Well, the money's moving in other directions. So let's take our biggest retailer, Tesco. They're perhaps investing in what they call club card prices. So they're offering promotions, but it's just for people who've got their club card, which is great for them because, it's great for me as a shopper because I don't have to make any effort. There's no redeeming of points or any of that nonsense to go on. That's really straightforward. And it's great for Tesco because they get an awful lot of data out of their if you use your club card every time. So it's going in that. And generally speaking, the industry has moved in the jargon is everyday low prices. So this is the idea. Instead of having something that's on the shelf at £2 and nobody buys it and it's £1, 90% of the sales go through £1. We're moving away from that model, and we're moving away from multi-buy model as well, where, three for the price of two or two for a tenner or whatever it might be, and towards the idea of just keeping prices low every time. Now, that is, quite frankly, is copying the discounters model. It's simpler. And it also takes out the really awkward to manage volume spikes, because a promotion's great. I love them as a shopper. It's half price. I'll buy three of them. That shelf is cleared in 20 minutes. And then you've got to have people, where do you store the stuff? It's a very lean supply chain. There's not a lot of space out the back. And you've got to have people to get in the way of other customers and restock the gondola end and all those kind of things. So that's where the money has gone. So for these retailers, it really is about, I need to offer something that is either cheap or offers good value that means somebody doesn't walk out the store. Now, that could be about offering an own label, or, of course, value is not just about price. They're often used as synonyms, but actually sometimes things can be relatively expensive, but I feel I'm getting a good deal because it's high quality. And that's a battleground that the discounters are taking back the other way. Aldi and Lidl used to be only about cheap. You go into there now, they've got quite a lot of their own premium ranges in there. So they're becoming a little bit more mainstream in a way.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into this conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out another one where we interviewed Professor Tim Lang about the epic challenges being thrown at the food industry in the UK. To find it, go to foodmatterslive.com and search Feeding Britain. Now, back to the chat. And what about, Tim, what about looking at this on a global scale? I mean, maybe it's not that relevant, but are most countries in Europe suffering from the same sort of inflation that we're having? And is it having the same effect on the food markets in those countries?
Yeah, I think the picture is pretty much universal, actually, because most of the underlying pressures are global pressures. It's odd because the actual commodity markets themselves, you know, aren't spiking. It's what happens, you know, between the farm and the fork that where the action is really going on, and that just emphasises the role of energy in bringing food to the consumer. You know, I've read that in the US, one calorie of food takes 10 calories of energy, primarily oil in the production, processing and transportation of food throughout the food chain. So those global pressures are everywhere. And if you look at the data, you know, European rates of inflation and food inflation, you know, aren't too dissimilar to here in the UK. Although there's quite a bit of variation, actually. You know, food prices are falling in Switzerland, they're falling in China, yet they're growing, you know, very, very rapidly in the US, and they're starting to pick up in the UK, in Germany and France.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are global pressures underlying this, but there are also some sort of domestic pressures. And of course, we've got to mention the B word. You know, Brexit does increase the cost of trade.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're buying half of our food, whether it's in raw or processed forms, from the rest of the world. And as a result, so what happens at the border is going to make a big difference. And this will impact not only on the cost of the food that we import, but also the cost of exporting as well.
And we're recording this on the 22nd of February. It was just announced this morning that Russia invaded Donetsk and Luhansk in Ukraine. Ukraine certainly has been known as the world's breadbasket, but it's more about global security and oil prices, I guess. Is this going to have an effect as well, Tim? I know this, it's just sort of developing the story, but we've known about it, the possibility of it happening for quite a while.
Yeah, I mean, events happen all the time. This is just the latest one. But as the sort of the data tells us, these kind of international events do happen within increasing regularity. There's something that the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, create called a World Uncertainty Index. And that reached its peak in 2019, and it just will go off the scale in the last sort of 2 years, what with the pandemic and also sort of concerns about Russia and Ukraine. But there's tensions between North and South Korea, the Americans, the Chinese, you know, these sorts of things play out in world markets all the time.
But it has always been like this to some extent. Is it worse now than it has been for the last 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, if you look even further back, you know, this World Uncertainty Index, you know, that goes back 60 years, and it's higher now than it's ever been. So, you know, including sort of the Vietnam War and, you know, the invasion of Iraq. All of these periods lead to spikes in uncertainty. But the sort of the high level that we're experiencing at the moment is unprecedented.
Well, you bring the tone down, Tim. I think it's time for one of your mother-in-law jokes. But I hear what you're saying.
I am an economist, after all. We're not known as the dismal scientists for nothing.
Okay, Fraser, now let's just pull this apart a little bit. Is it true that fresh food prices aren't rising as fast as other sectors, and why would this be?
It is true. So if you look at fruit and veg, for instance, it's not going up as fast as other categories. But trying to find patterns in which of those categories are experiencing really high inflation and which aren't is actually surprisingly hard to do because there's an awful lot going on. So there are, and some of this is quite frankly not visible to an analyst like me. So some of it is to do with commercial negotiations. Suppliers will give to wholesalers or to supermarkets on contracts that are of a fixed term with certain times. And, you know, they will then get renegotiated. And prices will be locked in to a large degree until that contract comes up. The other one I talked about is this element of promotions. Actually, what happens in a particular category? Inflation is a funny measure because we sort of talk of it as a synonym for rising cost of living. It's not quite the same. It is actually inflation in my world, and Tim's an economist and he'll tell me I'm using the word wrongly here, but I use it for a like-for-like price increase between a product that was on sale last year and a product that's on sale this year. If different products are on sale this year, or some products have been delisted, then actually the inflation numbers might not catch everything. Categories that particularly of note that are actually, the prices are going up highest, pasta at the moment going up about 18%, crisps and snacks. It's a little bit hard to discern if that's one of the major suppliers who's had some famous computer problems, or it's actually the cost of potatoes, that's going up about 10%. But what's really difficult, I think, for us as shoppers at the moment is in more normal times, if you'd asked me to plot a distribution, we track about 300 categories in the supermarket of inflation, not just food, because there's health and beauty and household in there as well. If you can, in your mind's eye now, I don't want to get too technical, if you wanted to plot a distribution of those 300 categories, it basically, say inflation was running at 2%, there would be a normal distribution around that 2% average. The chart, which I plotted this morning, and had a look at it, is now very, very skewed. So thinking back to your school maths, the mean, the median and the mode, the modal inflation, i.e. the most popular of about 100 categories, is sort of running in the sort of 0 to 3% level. But there's quite a few categories that are just pushed out in your mind's eye to the right of that. There's a huge skew of categories where inflation is running much higher. What there isn't, in many categories where prices are falling. This is getting into behavioural science, really, isn't it? We're all very critical when we notice a price going up. What consumers don't notice at all, really, is when a price goes down. So in normal times, with inflation running at 2%, our increases, oh my goodness, my favourite brand's gone up 20%, is terrible. We don't notice that our other favourite brand is on promotion all the time and is much cheaper. And that would offset it. That offsetting is now not happening. And basically, price rises are happening slightly, overgeneralizing, but to a broad degree in just about every category, some of them very fast and some of them quite you know, sort of minimal, but definitely not falling at you have in more usual times. Other than that, picking out from the data why a category should be up or down is actually quite hard.
So Tim, with all this, the confusion of how the prices are changing, do you see some parts of the food supply chain likely to collapse? Will businesses disappear, do you think? Or if, you know, it's back to that thing of, can you pass the price rise on? If it's not possible, then companies are going to find it very difficult to continue trading, aren't they?
Well, you know, it's inescapable. We all need food to eat. So, you know, the food chain itself isn't going to collapse, but certainly some parts of the chain are going to come under very, very strong pressure. And as Fraser has already mentioned, it's that food service that possibly looks the most vulnerable.
Especially after COVID and lockdowns.
Yeah, and as you know, as we start to sort of rein in our spending, the first thing that we might do is buy our food from supermarkets more than from cafes and restaurants. So they're probably in the front line, not least because from the demand side, but of course their costs are rising quite significantly. You know, energy costs and also labour is particularly expensive in that sector, and you know, difficult to find trained members of staff who are willing to work at the sort of pre-pandemic wage levels.
So let's now think about the people at the lower end of the income scale, and the effects that it might have. Now, Richard Walker, managing director of Iceland, said that there's been an alarming rise in the use of food banks and that he's losing customers to hunger. What sort of effects does this have on people's diets and health, would you say, Tim?
Well, just to just take it one step back, this is a real problem and possibly the biggest problem in rising food prices, in that, you know, for many segments of the population, you know, we can ride the storm. But for many at the sort of the lower income end of the distribution, it really is a question of sort of heat or eat. It's a social problem more than a sort of an economic one. And it's something that sort of concerns, you know, policymakers, economists, and just about everyone, actually, because that isn't the sort of decision that we want anyone to make in the fifth richest country in the world. Mm. So there is a real problem there.
We've done some research recently, and we've, you know, asking people about their financial status, and about just under a fifth of UK households are pretty much struggling financially to some degree, and we do see that impacts how much they spend on their food. That, you know, it's been a time when people have had to spend more on food due to COVID, or certainly at home food due to COVID, and the increases amongst that poorest group were less than everybody else. And then it's a public health issue as well, because some of the cheapest food that we have happens to also be some of the unhealthiest food that we have. And this is something that, you know, Public Health England are obviously, you know, fully aware of. There are the HFSS regulations coming in the next year or so, which is going to...
A lot of change going to unfold anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Which is going to, you know, it's massively change how some foods are marketed and sold. And the assumption is, and we wait and see, that is people will be buying less of those. Now, obviously, if you're a snack company or a ready meals manufacturer, this is a big thing for your business. What we don't see in our data is a huge change in the rate of inflation between the sort of richest and the poorest, or the most comfortable and the least well off. But I think that might hide the fact that people who are spending more do have more choices. So if I'm currently spending all my money on a premium own label, I can choose to buy a cheaper product in store. I can go down several tiers. If I'm already buying the cheapest item in store, I haven't got that release valve. I can't make that decision to buy a little bit cheaper. And I think that's a big problem for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we're going to come back to that for our last question. But just as a slight tangent, in terms of innovation and risk taking in the food system, during these times where consumers are reining things in, does that mean that companies are stifled by rising prices and they don't innovate, they don't come up with new products? Tim, do you think that there will be less change in the food industry, that where companies sort of batten down and just do their damnedest with what they've got? Or do they have to keep innovating and trying out new products?
Yeah, innovation is king. If you don't innovate, chances are you're not going to be around in 5 years, because consumer patterns of consumption, you know, are changing. It may appear gradual at any one point in time, but if you sort of stand back from it, you can see that change is occurring. And, you know, in particular, the movement towards plant-based foods. I mean, it's in part...
Which has been an expensive sector, comparatively, I guess, up till now.
Yeah, that's true. It's some of the most, you know, sort of premium brands, and, you know, they're sort of expensive products, but they're picking up on this change in consumer perceptions towards what one could call a sort of a healthier diet. Aren't always healthier, of course, these products, but certainly the ultra processed products that Fraser mentioned, you know, they're likely to come under, you know, very strong pressure. Not only is there public policy pressure, but as consumers, you know, switch their consumption away from sort of buying a snack or lunch when they're at work from a shop, they'll be making that at home. And generally speaking, home prepared food is a lot healthier than food that's purchased in retail outlets.
So it could go both ways, I guess. It's really interesting, isn't it? Okay, so I've got a final question for both of you, really. I mean, we need to make sure that the poorest in our society just don't get continually hammered and thrown to the economic wolves, because it creates systemic problems. It ruins society, and it's just downright evil not to help. So I know that it's our job to analyse and question, but do you have any thoughts about what can be done to mitigate the effects of inflation for the poorest? forest in society. Fraser, anything that you would like to see happening?
I think we should give a little bit of credit here to our major retailers, because they do offer incredible choice. Now, that might not be the choice that everybody wants in terms of the content of the food. Is it healthy? Is it good quality and all that? But it has to be said that there is a huge amount of choice out there for people to make those decisions. And I think, you know, certainly during the pandemic, we came to recognise that the food supply chain which was actually incredibly resilient after a very difficult start with those empty shelves, was actually something we'd always taken for granted and is actually pretty essential to our way of life. And a lot of people working in a lot of food manufacturers and food retailers were putting themselves at considerable risk by working throughout that pandemic. So I think continuing to offer that choice and offering it at all ends of the price spectrum, if that's not too bizarre a thing to say when we're talking about, you know, helping people out, because even those people who are suffering financially, are very, very few of them are luckily are only buying the very cheapest products on the shelves. For the majority of people, they are able to pick up other items. And I know that doesn't help the tiny minority that really are suffering and perhaps going to food banks. But for most people, they are buying a variety of things. Keeping that choice going. We know that supermarkets have been reducing ranges over the last 5 years or so, and that's partly because it's more efficient to stock fewer items. It just makes your whole logistics and supply chain and stocking easier. So just keep those options on the shelf so people can make the decisions at the right time financially for them, what works for them at that moment.
Fantastic. Okay, Tim, what can be done to help the poorest in society?
This is a problem, actually, and it's going to be an increasingly sort of important one. I mean, I heard fairly recently that if food banks were a retailer, they'd be in the top 10 in the UK, which was a sort of a startling statistic. That just indicates that food banks are not only used by the very poorest members of society, they're increasingly becoming an important source of food for people who have full-time jobs. Mm. I mean, one thing that I think we really need to do is target support more. And so government efforts to sort of make everyone a little better off, well, you know, you can see they have to do that from a sort of political point of view. But to solve the problem, I think it's going to require a lot more targeted support on those people who are primarily on benefits. And, you know, the national living wage has increased, or is about to increase, quite substantially. And when sort of initiated, when planned, that was going to give a real boost to the spending power of low income households. But because inflation is rising at such a rapid rate, that's just sort of cushioning the blow. So I think there is a real case for government to do more, particularly targeted towards low income consumers.
A more caring society would help us all, I think.
I think inequality is one of the most sort of critical issues, not only, you know, in the UK, but sort of more generally. Unequal societies are generally not happy societies. And I think this is something that really needs to be paid attention to.
And if we don't get this right, I think things crumble at all levels of society, and everyone suffers in the end. Okay, well, I hope that hasn't been too grim a picture. But Tim Lloyd and Fraser McKevitt, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Table Talk podcast. We've got hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. For instance, if you search Career Conversations, you'll get our new series all about the many jobs you might not know exist within the food industry. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.